It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Might be hard to believe in the age of artisan microbreweries, but Schlitz, the beer that made Milwaukee famous, once dominated the market.
So let's get together with a glass of Schlitz, a great light beer from Schlitz.
With just a kiss of the hops, Schlitz became the top-selling beer in the country in the late 1940s.
Real gusto in a great light beer, Schlitz.
The beer that made Milwaukee famous simply because it tastes so good.
But that Milwaukee institution came crashing down in the 1970s after a heated market war with Budweiser, a questionable ad campaign, and a marketing corruption scandal that led to federal prosecution.
The authors of a new Esquire magazine article chronicle that story, centering around Bob Martin, a key player in the Schlitz marketing campaigns that led to its downfall.
David Bourgeois is a Brooklyn-based writer who has written about film, music, and politics, and Michael Lander is an award-winning writer and director. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
David, what made the two of you want to tell this story about the downfall of Schlitz beer?
Well, I first learned of Bob Martin. I first met Bob Martin as a kid. He was actually good friends with my parents. And as a kid, as kind of a teenager, I first learned about something called the house that Schlitz built, which my parents and Bob Martin would joke about. And that happened at a Christmas party one year when I was kind of relegated to the bartender role. And I kept overhearing my parents and Bob laugh about the house that Schlitz built. So as a teenager, I never really kind of thought much more about that. But then as I became a writer, moved to New York, still kind of wondered what all of that was about. Because at the time, Bob was also in the news. He had sued Schlitz. So he was one of my parents' friends who was just in the news. So I kind of knew about him. So as I got older, I kind of thought it was an interesting story and I didn't really know much about it. And I started to just do a little digging, reached out to Bob, who was retired and living in Kansas City at the time. Bob was only too happy to talk about himself and talk about his days at Schlitz. So I flew to Kansas City, stayed with him for a couple nights, chatted with him, and then kind of reached out to Michael because I was thinking at least that this could be a film. And Michael, who's in the film industry, once I told Michael the whole story, he was kind of smitten and was interested in kind of helping it progress. So that's kind of how the story kind of was, you know, birthed.
And we'll meet Bob Martin and learn more about him in a bit. But Michael, can you first set the stage for us? Mid-20th century, I think you guys use the phrase Milwaukee being something like the Silicon Valley of the beer industry. Can you talk about that scene and why beer was such a dominant force?
Well, I'm a screenwriter. I'm a writer, director. So I always sort of look at everything through that lens. And when he brought it to me, I was like, this looks like the cast of Anchorman starring in Goodfellas in Milwaukee in the late 1970s with a lot of heart. There's a lot going on in the background, but Milwaukee, Dave can probably speak to the state of Milwaukee in the 70s better than I can, but it really was a central hub. There were four major breweries. You could have, you could go to work at one of those breweries and have a really nice working class life. You could raise a family and have kids and a house and have a, you know, eke out a really nice sort of middle class life for yourself. And it was a very attractive place to try to go and work. And Bob was one of those guys who right out of college was like, hell yeah, I'm going to go work at one of the, you know, the second largest brewery in the world, a multi-billion dollar company at the time. They were only second to Anheuser-Busch. And 1957 is when Budweiser passed Schlitz as being the number one beer manufacturer in the world. So it was a hotbed place to work. It was super cool. There was even a television show in the 70s called Laverne and Shirley that took place in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And they worked in a brewery called Schatz. Right? Am I getting that right? Is it Schatz or
Schatz Brewery?
Schatz Brewery. That's right. Yeah.
And David, we don't like Schlitz. You can, it got resurrected recently, but it was a phantom beer for a long time. And now it's just kind of a, you know, part of a retro beer thing now. This was a big deal. It was a huge company, right? As it was number one and then number two for a while, which is part of what makes this story amazing. Why this a huge company went away. Talk about the heyday of Schlitz a little bit.
Yeah, well, you know, in the 1950s, Schlitz was, you know, they were at that point, they were the number one beer. It, you know, they certainly ping ponged back and forth between Schlitz and Anheuser-Busch. But, you know, Schlitz, their revenue in the 50s, they had years where they were making billions in revenue. I mean, you know, billions with a B, and for a family run brewery, which it was, the Eline family ran it for decades. That is a lot of money. And it was just an economic juggernaut. And then, you know, as the 50s kind of turned into the 60s, things got a little tighter. By the 70s, Schlitz was kind of a little bit struggling. There were issues with some of the actual quality of the beer. And as we talk about in our article, there was some disastrous ad campaigns as well. So, you know, kind of looking at Schlitz from the 50s on through the 70s, and then it was, you know, sold off for parts in the early 80s. It brought in so much money, and it was a real economic engine for the, you know, obviously not just the family that owned it, but for the city as well. It, you know, employed thousands of people. And it was just a, you know, and it, like, of course, trying to take over the number one spot from Anheuser-Busch was certainly what Schlitz was attempting to do with these accounts of influence, which were trying, you know, Schlitz was trying to get into stadiums and airports and all of that stuff. So it was a time where in the early 50s where Schlitz was doing well, but they were also starting to lose some of their market share. And it was kind of a pretty vitriolic war between Anheuser-Busch and Schlitz.
And David, your main character in this story, Bob Martin, is very aggressive in his marketing. Can you talk about the sort of things that they were doing at Schlitz to try to make sure that everything from that corner bar to the baseball stadium had their beer and only their beer?
Yeah, well, there, you know, part of the SEC indictments, most of them were misdemeanors. There are, you know, 747 counts, but some of the things that Bob Martin was spearheading were, as we mentioned in our article, were kind of comical. I mean, to the point of just, you know, very, very small infractions, such as going into local bars and kind of walking into a bar and saying, oh, you know, looks like your floor could use to, you know, possibly you could use a new floor. Well, we can kind of take care of that. We at Schlitz can kind of take care of that as long as you ensure that, you know, of the, let's say, six taps, Schlitz is in five of the six, or, you know, so they would go into local bars, which of course is kind of small potatoes, but they also, as I mentioned, were kind of going for these accounts of influence, which were like O'Hare Airport in the 60s. It was the largest draft beer account in the nation. So they kind of saw an entryway there once Budweiser had a strike. So they would do things like,
which Bob had insider information.
Yes.
I think Bob went to college with a guy who was working there at Budweiser and actually called Bob and tipped him off that it was going to happen.
Yeah.
Total insider trading.
Yeah. And there were also, you know, there were also things like, for example, Schlitz in the early 70s, Schlitz paid money to the, you know, the Conrad Hilton Hotel. They paid them about $10,000. For the purported rental of a hotel suite for a cocktail party, right? That cocktail party never happened. So there were ways that Schlitz would kind of do end runs around, you know, the law to ensure that Schlitz got prominent placement in hotels and all of this stuff. So they kind of ran a couple different sets of books. They ran a lot of money through advertising agencies that never did any advertising. It was really all of a way to get money back to venues, to, you know, to bars, to ballparks, to train stations, train hubs, you name it. And they would have to come up with fairly inventive ways of moving money around. So that, you know, and there's instance after instance of it. Some of them, as we mentioned, are comical. Some of them required a lot of people just making kind of shell companies in order to kind of get the money back to the venue. So it was a fairly complicated procedure.
And Michael Schlitz may have thought of this as aggressive marketing. Well, hold on. Federal investigators thought of this as kickbacks and bribes. Speaking of movie moments, you tell the story in your piece about Schlitz saying effectively, yeah, come on in. We've got nothing to hide. Go through our offices. No problem. And then what happened?
Stephen Kravitz is what happened. Stephen Kravitz, 25 years old, I believe, at the time, third year Harvard graduate. Ends up going into the offices of Schlitz, and he went in mid-late morning, and they told him that Schlitz was absolutely confident they had nothing to hide. Every 2 years, they had a two-year document policy where basically they kept no document older than 2 years. So clearly, Schlitz had thought they had gone through and scrubbed the entire office. And there's Stephen Kravitz, 25 years old, with his glasses, says, hey, I can go anywhere. And they're like, yeah, you can go anywhere. So he walks into one of the offices. It's Gustafson, right, Dave?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So he walks into Gustafson's office, who was like a big sales guy, and opens, sits at his desk, opens a drawer. And there is essentially the second set of books, the ledgers, the correspondences with everyone. These guys were incredibly hubristic about their sort of sales conquests. They kept carbon copies. So, you know, in the old days before email and all that, you had a carbon copy. You know, you had a blue copy, a yellow copy, a green copy. You would write on the top copy and it would, you know, push the ink all the way through, all the way down. And that's what he found. And it really became the cornerstone of the 747 count indictment that ended up going against Schlitz. And again, with, you know, some skunky beer and some horrible advertising, that was sort of the trinity that really brought down a $1 billion company in a matter of 5-6 years.
We're talking about the downfall of Schlitz Brewing Company, once the most popular beer in the country. David Bourgeois and Michael Lander chronicled its downfall for Esquire magazine. You've both mentioned those ads. I want to give a listen to one of the Gusto ad campaign. Here it is.
Excuse me, champ. Great fight. Now, we'd like to take away your Schlitz and have you endorse our beer.
Cool. You want to take away my Gusto? Say, you tickle me. You want to take away my Schlitz, my Gusto? Well, I'm going to play Picasso
and put you on the canvas.
David, I watched a bunch of ads from this series before I talked to you guys. This is one of the less violent ones. This one, the star is only going to beat you for questioning a Schlitz. Others will actually murder you,
right,
if you try to take this. This didn't go over well, apparently.
It was so disastrously bad that it is this ad campaign is literally taught in some marketing classes on exactly how not to market a product. and it's as the ad that you played is awesome, and it's just like kind of like head scratching. And I think there's another one of that series where there's like a guy out in the wilderness, and there's like a mountain lion.
His mountain lion will eat you. He'll sick his mountain lion on you, or his cougar, if you take away a Schlitz.
Which is just like, if you kind of think about this, and the guy who kind of dreamed up these ads, Leo Burnett, who was, you know, an ad legend, maybe he thought these were going to be kind of tongue in cheek, or maybe he thought these were going to be kind of funny. But in essence, what they did is they actually drove people away from the beer, because they were kind of, they were a little creepy and a little just like frightening. They actually weren't that funny. Certainly in retrospect, they're funny. But when you're kind of playing it at the time, people were like, what are these things? You know?
And we'll leave it there. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. This was great.
That was David Bourgeois and Michael Lander. Their article about the fall of Milwaukee's Schlitz Brewing Company is in July's Esquire magazine. Hey, do you have memories, fond or otherwise, of the heyday of Schlitz beer or its downfall? Were you there working for the company? Are there old Schlitz signs passed down in your family? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.